From the shadowy depths of the city, where justice and mystery intertwine, emerges a broadcast as daring and vigilant as the masked Avenger himself. You are tuned in to the Green Hornet Case Files, unveiling the legacy and cultural significance of one of the greatest crime fighters of all time. Now, let the adventure begin. Here are your hosts, Corey and Greg.
That's us, man.
Man, I'm so stoked. We're back for episode, what is this? 14?
2.5.
I can't count. Math was never a strong suit of mine. Episode 2, getting going of the Green Hornet Case Files. And I just posted, I don't know if you saw it or not, Corey, we had a photographer in here last week take a picture of the two of us. Camera, I understand, will be repairable.
Yeah, it did. It did make a loud cracking noise.
It did. But that one image...
I'm not kidding, man. It's one of the few photos of myself I've seen where I was like, eh, it's not too bad.
Yeah, pretty good. That's pretty good. And I gotta say, we have had just an incredible response from the Green Hornet community for the podcast. I mean, every time I look,
not one shut up, you idiots. Not
well, I haven't told you about those.
Oh, dang it. No, everything I received was super positive. Everything you've sent me that people have shared with you has been super, super positive.
It really has.
My favorite part of it is a ton of people, friends of mine, that were like, hey, man, I don't know anything about this, but it was a good listen and I want to learn. Like, so I'm going to keep tuning in. And that means the world to me.
That's the whole point of this is, besides you and I having a good conversation about something we both love, is to share that love.
Yeah, absolutely.
I had an email from a Facebook fan, and he called himself. He says, I am a Facebook fan now. You know, I'm a fan of you guys.
Oh, cool.
And we went back and forth yesterday morning. I think it was on Facebook Messenger. And just said, hey, you know, what do you like about, you know, the Green Hornet? What do you think about? And he's a young guy that was discovered Green Hornet through his grandfather.
Oh, cool.
Who found some old video cassettes. And I'll see if I can find the young lad's name here. Kevin Karras.
Huge shout out to Kevin, man.
Yeah,
cool.
Man. It was a great conversation. Dude. So... And that's exactly what this is about, is trying to share the love of something that was created a very long time ago, mm-hmm. almost forgotten, then came back, almost forgotten again.
So when we were discussing these different demographics of people who have found it in one way, shape, or form.
Right.
So when we were talking about that, that wasn't even a demographic I thought of. People who had been introduced to it by their grandparents, who actually... dug it and dug in and enjoyed, and that's slick, man. I don't know why that didn't occur to me as an option.
And there it is,
right?
So coming up here in just a few minutes, in this podcast, number two of the Green Hornet Case Files, one of the guys that has done a lot of that digging back and pulling out and has actually come out with what we consider kind of the Bible in this, is Mr. Martin Grams is going to be joining us.
Absolutely. This is going to be a fun conversation. Again?
Again.
Do we want to discuss?
Well, we did this once last week?
Yeah.
With Martin.
Yep. And it was amazing.
So great interview. I just...
Take our word for it.
Because Zoom screwed us.
Oh, yeah. You know what's funny is we keep talking, the failure of Zoom. When I was talking to Snow about it, I was reminded of a Beetle Bailey comic that I had on my refrigerator for years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only because it's called Zoom. But it was Beetle Bailey and the Sarge standing there with a cannon, and they fire it, and it says, Moob.
Moob?
And then they turn the cannon the other direction and fire it, and it says, Boom. So this was our moose,
yeah,
as opposed to the Zoom.
The moose episode.
I know that didn't make sense to anybody but me, but.
The Green Hornet Case Files is bringing Martin Grams to the show, and Martin will be joining us via moose here in just a few minutes. The book is called The Green Hornet, A History of Radio, Motion Pictures, Comics, and Television, And this thing is, how many pages? I forget how many.
It's a weighty tome.
It is a weighty, weighty tome. 793, including the index. And he and Terry Solomonson just went to extremes to put this sucker together.
And I can't wait for everybody to hear, like, kind of how this came about, how this, his process and all of that. It's good stuff.
So one of the things that I want to dive into, we played a little piece of the music there at the intro, the Flight of the Bumblebee.
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually a topic in of itself. And while it was playing, I was sitting there thinking, I want to do an episode on just the music.
Yeah, we kind of talked about that. I'm excited for that.
Of the Green Hornet. And there's a reason for some of the music and the way the music was approached, and I can't wait to jump into that. Plus, I've had people coming out of the woodwork that want to be on the show.
Yeah, home. It's exciting.
It really is. Artists who did some of the comics, some of the writers that have done some of the Moonstone books are interested in being on the show. We're reaching out to Shannon Lee.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't throw that out there, but I just did.
Fingers crossed.
Hoping that, you know,
fingers crossed. So, you know, it's funny because we went into this thinking, you know, it'll be fun to do for the three or four people that'll check it out that are outside our extended family.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, I'm blown away. I really am.
I really am, too.
So and thank all of you so much.
And share. Please like and share. Like and share and subscribe.
Slap that subscribe button. Like, you're going to start hawking energy drinks any minute.
Yeah. Swyback. That was the name. We were having a conversation. We were having a conversation before we got here to the studio about wrestling.
And
wrestling, I was listening to or watching the show back in the 60s. And there was this guy that his name was something Swyback, and he would hawk his energy pills. And
see?
Why all of a sudden that popped into my...
It's all full circle, baby.
Boy, I tell you, I need my Swyback energy pills about this time. I tell
Speaking
you what,
of energy.
Yes.
You know, Martin's got that coffee shop opening up. Synergy, baby. Synergy.
I wonder if he can, like, through Moose, send us some some high-octane stuff.
Right?
Let's take a quick breather and be right back with Martin Grimes. So here we are back in the studio, and as I promised, we have Mr. Martin Grimes with us, who is the co-author of this magnificent tome. I'm getting my arm workout with this book here, Martin. The Green Hornet, The History of Radio, Motion Pictures, Comics, and Television. And again, Corey and I alluded to the fact that we had a really nice conversation that will be lost to the ether forever, but to kind of start that conversation over again, what brought you to the Green Hornet?
Well, thank you for having me on the show. It's a pleasure. Yeah, it's a cockroach killer. I know someone threatened to send me a bill if they get carpal tunnel syndrome.
I'm just planning on getting your Lone Ranger book and then setting it up like a booby trap, like when they took out the AT-ATs in Return of the Jedi. Like they swing down and just smash
them. Yeah.
I remember reading somewhere they said a good book should never be rushed in production. But the problem is also a good book is a big book like these, because my belief has always been you should have that one book that if you have a question you need answered. In this case, how much was Bruce Lee getting paid to be on the Green Hornet per episode? Or what was the actual start premiere broadcast date of the radio program? Or any of those little trivia, you should be able to pull this book off the shelf and be able to answer those questions. And so that's why I've done all the books that I've written in that same manner. So when people ask me a question, if they can't find it in the book, it's sometimes because the book is so big. But if they can't find it because it's not in the book, then I do not know the answer. It's that those are that detail. Terry and I put the book together. It was a love of the program, a love of the series. We felt it needed some justice. Also, we had access to a lot of archives over the years, mainly for the Lone Ranger project. project. But of course, there's that crossover from the same producers for the Green Hornet. So it just seemed natural as we go to archives across the country. I would say we spent probably a total of 20 years researching, and then probably like a year to year and a half putting it together. And then another year and a half, because they say 90% of writing is the editing. So that's what ended up accumulating, an 800-page book documenting everything you could want to know about the Green Hornet, except the Seth Rogen movie. This was written and published before the Seth Rogen movie, but even then, sometimes you have to stop and say, where do I stop and where do I end? So we stopped, and I don't even think we touched on the Dynamite comics that were done recently either. But no big deal. These are the classic Green Hornet that we all love.
Well, and it's been invaluable to what Greg and I are setting out to do and answering so many questions for us. And it's funny you mentioned the Seth Rogen movie, because I know I kind of hit you with that last conversation. Is I like to know what people's take on that is, because it's insanely divisive within the fan community of the Hornet. And so, you know, there are people who hate it, and there are people who are like, eh, it's fine. And there are people who hate it.
I'm probably one of those in the middle. I'm appreciative that they actually made a movie of the Green Hornet so they could expose it to a younger audience. I'm looking to see forward to David's new rendition, which will come out without Seth Rogen, and probably in a couple years, assuming that that does truly get off the ground, and it probably will. My only concern was it was just not the Green Hornet as it should be. It was more of a comedy. I remember Seth Rogen, he was on a late night talk show, and they asked him about the radio show. And he literally said on the air, well, the radio show sucks. The TV show with Bruce Lee is awesome. And I kept thinking to myself, he has no idea what the heck he is doing. And then when he referred to the Green Hornet as a superhero, I'm thinking, dude, he's not superpowered. He's not Superman or Wonder Woman. He's a mass vigilante. If you can't tell the difference between a mass vigilante and a superhero, we're all doomed. And that's what happened. It's kind of like a cross between an idiot who wanted to be the Green Hornet and the Green Hornet that we are familiar with as a Playboy newspaper owner by day and mass vigilante at night. I don't think he understood exactly what the character truly was. They just ran with it and had the license. And sadly, I think it might have made some money. But I think my only concern is the younger audience, as much as they are exposed to an older property like this, they're giving the wrong idea of what it is. And it just doesn't sell it to them either.
You made a comment during our last interview about Britt Reed. And you were commenting in regards to having read all of the radio scripts as part of the background process for putting this book together. And the comment you made about Britt Reed, Corey is laughing because I had to pick my ass up off the floor as you said this comment. And then it's like,
I watched it settle in, you know, just as the wave crested and took him back a little bit. But you had said specifically that you mentioned that Britt was at his core a coward.
So yes. Explain that to us again there, young fella.
Yeah, the radio program, a little more than half of the 1,000 episodes exist in recorded form. So in order for me to get the plot summaries for the ones that recordings do not exist, especially since they never recorded the first 2 years, and it was a business decision back then, not historical preservation, I had to read all those radio scripts. The best of them made it worth it, but when you get towards the end of it, it's kind of like a chore. But it was still fun to do. But as a result, I think I have a deep respect and understanding of the character itself, in as much as Franz Stryker created it. Of course, it's based on loosely on the pulp novels of The Adventures of Jimmy Dale. And it occurred to me progressively as I was going through them that he is pretty much a coward. And he is. His biggest fear is not getting shot by the villains or wounded. His biggest fear is not Cato getting injured or anything. It's fear of exposure. His biggest fear is being caught, exposed, and becomes the villain that he didn't want to be, that he was masterminding and pretending to be in order to lure the villains out and make them comfortable enough where he could trip them up and alert them to the police. So his big method was he would leave Cato off the side. Cato would either be in the Black Beauty, ready to push the button, which was a starter button back then, and speed away in the event of a quick getaway so he wouldn't get caught, or Cato was right outside the window, ready to shoot the lights out. So if something dangerously came close, then, you know, the light bulb would be shot out, it gets in darkness, and the Green Hornet would get away. That's the reason why he had the gas gun. Not so much he didn't want to kill the other villains because he didn't want to be in trouble for killing someone, but it basically he wanted, if they came too close to him, if they approached 1 foot too close, he could use the gas gun and knock them out. So it occurred to me that he's actually more of a coward than anything. And he did this job as a mass vigilante solely to help clean up the streets, which makes sense in a sense when you get to, say, November of 47, when his father's secretary, Linda Travis, jumps in the back of a black car, and Britt Reed and Cato get in there, and the mask comes off, and she discovers that it's Britt Reed. And that's obviously the start of what became a new story arc in which his father would ultimately discover he was the Green Hornet. That episode is actually titled Exposed, which I think is proper for the biggest fear he had is exposure. Britt Reed, the character, was a coward, in my opinion, and it doesn't make him any more or less a hero by standards of, like, say, watching the TV show or listening to the radio program. But since the radio program is more based on pulp stories, you listen to them now and you'll start noticing that, yeah, he's more of a hero. He doesn't want to get caught. He doesn't want to be apprehended. He doesn't want the mask to fall off and someone discover who his identity is. That was his biggest fear more than anything.
So to me, that kind of the first time when we were having this conversation, I kind of took that when you said that, it made me actually kind of appreciate Rogan's take just a little bit more than I had before, because I think that maybe he leaned too far into it, but that was a bit kind of what he was hitting in there. Now, granted, it was slapsticky and stoner humored up, but it's at the end of the day, like, that's kind of a different take, and you're nailing it as the kind of a crux of the character. Maybe it's amplified in a different way, but it's still kind of true.
Do you think that that's a crux of all mass vigilante characters? Do you think, Martin, that, you know, they're all afraid of being discovered?
Well, there's a reason they are masked in the first place, yes. In some cases, I think every author or creator who created any type of mass vigilante, fictional anyway, it was a variation on a theme. So this one was Justin Green. This one went off and did that. This one did that. They're all, like, even superheroes, they're all variations of a theme. There's no originality. Even Tom Dougal, who created Sergeant Preston of the Yukon, part of this WXYZ connection, you know, the Green Hornet, Lone Ranger, so on. He even said nobody ever creates. Everybody just borrows, and then they create their own variation. Or as someone once went to Franz Stryker and said, "My God, you're the man who created the Lone Ranger and Green Hornet." And Stryker said, "No, only God creates. We borrow."
So when you started down this WXYZ verse, I'm going to call it in the parlance of entertainment now, where did you start? What brought you to all of this? Well, did you start with the Hornet, or did you start with the Lone Ranger, or how'd you get to it?
Well, we started with the Green Hornet because it was the one we had the most info and enough that we could finish a book right then and there. Lone Ranger, by comparison, had 3,400 radio shows. The Green Hornet was 1,000. So it was easier with all the material we had to get the Green Hornet book done first. And then after that, we did the first of what would be, apparently, it's going to be 4 or 5 volumes, or maybe even 6 of the Lone Ranger. Sergeant Preston will be 1 volume, but we're still going through them. Anyway, Green Hornet, we had all the scripts. We went through all the material. So basically, we just tracked down all the family relatives. If there's a son or daughter from someone who was involved, whether it be the lawyer who represented Trendle, Trendle's son, Trendle's family. We went to the Bruce Lee estate for permission to use anything. Cato. We went through William Dozer's archive because he was producing the Green Hornet TV show. It was just as we were researching other projects, we knew what was also at those same archives. Or in some cases, let's say Lenore Case's daughter, Lenore Case was Casey on their radio show. Her daughter still had some material, so we went through there. We went through James Jewell's collection. He was the director of the program for the first 2 years on radio. We just tracked down every archive we could, and we Xeroxed everything, we digitized. And it's actually an interesting fun fact. Most people think when you write a book and you get it out there, it is a form of preservation, but I don't think they realize it also means every photograph, every scribble on a radio script, and many of the radio scripts, they all get scanned into PDF. So we also do a digital form of preservation besides writing a book. So to say that almost all 1,000 Green Hornet radio scripts are scanned, not exactly true. I wish we had, but we were in the process of starting that at the point. But almost everything else related to the series has been digitized and done backups of backups. So it's a lot of work, but Green Hornet was the first, and now we're on to the Lone Ranger.
Speaking of the scripts, this is how you and I basically wound up together, is that backward math, and again, I'm not great at math, but backward math showed me that, as you mentioned, the first year and, well, basically 2 years, they didn't record the show. What happened to those episodes? Well, nothing, because they were performed live and they were lost into the ether, but the original scripts still existed. And I went with the idea that, I'm an old radio guy. We should reproduce those first 300 and some odd, I think, scripts. And we did one. Corey was part of the whole group here. We did one. It came out pretty good.
Yeah.
But I don't know that I necessarily see a future. I spoke with David Grace, the lawyer, and I don't know how we make any money off of it, but there is one.
What I liked about what is as Martin is describing the formula is I'm going, yep, that happened in the episode we did, and that happened in the episode. And then Cato shooting out the light bulb happened in the episode.
Yeah, and it's also interesting to see that the original radio program in the earliest years was a slightly different rendition of the Green Hornet than the version we're familiar with by 38 when they started recording the programs on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
In those early ones, he would leave behind a seal, for example. So when the police showed it up, they would notice that, hey, look, there's a seal here. It's the Green Hornet. So even if they just missed him, they knew the Hornet had been there. In the case of, like, say, The Adventures of Jimmy Dale, he was also known as the Gray Seal.
The Gray Seal, right.
The seal that was on the scene. So there's a rendition. I know there's earliest of 38 episodes that exist in recorded form. He's leaving the seal, but they dropped that over time. And that's one example that's easily able to be noticed now with those extant recordings. But in those early year, in the earliest, like the first year, Cato was constantly under the hood, making the Black Beauty even faster. There wasn't so many gadgets, but he was constantly tweaking things. Green Hornet at one point had a discussion with Cato about we need to draw a line about how far we're going to cross because some gangster got killed, and it turns out Cato threw him in a car. He knew it was going to get bombed. That was a trap for them, and of course the guy got killed. Technically, Cato committed a murder. And those early radio shows, I always say, evolved over time. They were never created overnight. And so there's almost like an early rendition and a formula of development in the earliest years until about 38 when they kind of pretty much have it down pat. And then it just becomes cookie cutter format episode after episode.
As you go through that experience of watching it find its feet, which often my favorite things, like the first season sucks. Like it's just
most series,
you know. Once it finds its feet, and I feel like we're losing that in the streaming age of cutting everything down to, you know, 10 episodes, 8 episodes, or whatever it happens to be. But in the course of watching this find its feet, do you have a particular era of the Hornet that grabs you, that speaks to you? Like, that's your Hornet?
There is, in a sense, yes. I find, like most radio shows and TV shows, the Green Hornet, no exceptions, tends to evolve over time. So there are certain time periods. Example, before 38, before they started recording them, you had the early rendition. Then from 38 to about 41, you had them going up against racketeers. Then you get from, say, 42 to about 44 or 45, he's going up against the Fifth Column and German spies and and Nazis and agents. And so it becomes a different formula because they're going after basically the enemies of World War II. And then it reverts a little bit back to the black market racketeers and saboteurs in the mid to late 40s, but because of the parents being concerned over juvenile delinquency, they decide to change it. So you get a story arc that evolves the program from the Green Hornet being wanted by the police by to a point where now he's no longer wanted by the police, and Commissioner Higgins is let in on it. And he's now assisting Britt in trying to escape from when the cops are there. Then you bring in an arch nemesis, Oliver Perry, that was a private detective who figures out who the Hornet is unable to convince the people that Britt Reed is Green Hornet, gets himself into enough trouble trying to do so that he becomes a felon, then an ex-con, and then he keeps coming back and back, and I like those adventures. And then it gets to the last year or two, and now he's going up against communist spies, and quite if it's not communist spies, there's some sort of shenanigans at the waterfront. So I find that the show evolves over time. My favorite are the World War II, because it's just a little bit more fresh, and it wasn't like, hey, we only got four plots. How do we do this? Now they've got 10 or 12 different types of plots they can use, and they were able to do enough variations. Plus, they brought in a few other characters like Clicker Binny and so on, like the female photographer.
The photographer, so right.
They kept it fresh a little bit here and there that it wasn't the same thing over and over. So I like the World War II episodes.
So as we wrap up and let you get back to the coffee shop, which I want to talk about real briefly here. If you're not aware, Martin has been working really hard on putting together this new coffee shop that's going to be a big boost to the community. Where are you at in the project as of the recording of this?
Oh, as of today, we're probably about 4 weeks from a soft opening. And this has been a 7-year project, so it's a good thing. There is many statues of the Green Hornet and Cato in the coffee shop on display. So that's, I always like to say, there's a little bit of me somewhere on the walls. You can
very
see
nice.
Them.
Nice.
Before. But it's not so much that kids go, that's too geeky. It's a comic book shop. So there's quite a lot in there. That makes it homespun, very welcoming. But I stuck some, you know, Hopalong Cassidy, Lone Ranger, Shadow, Green Hornet reference here and there that if people recognize and look around, they can clearly see them. Yes, it's a coffee shop. It's there to help the community. Crossing fingers, it will be a bigger success than we're anticipating based on numbers, but it's a good thing. It's called the Screaming Bean, and it's in Aberdeen, Maryland, right outside the Aberdeen Proving Ground. So that's pretty much what my daytime is, and most of my night times are being devoted to right now. It's a good thing, though. And hopefully we can introduce the Green Hornet to a younger audience from time to time. So maybe one night we'll have movie night and we'll play two or three episodes of the TV show, The Green Hornet, for some people, you know, so they can actually, even if they remembered seeing it as a kid and they're not kids today, they can hopefully get exposed to it again.
I'm just throwing this out there. Every copy shop's got jazz playing. You set those radio shows going.
My wife, that's my wife. Yep, our podcast. We actually probably have a couple that will be broadcast out of there or recorded out of there from time to time. And people can check it out at screamingbeancafe.com. But since we're talking about Green Hornet, if they want to take a look at the book, I think there's some PDF pages that were randomly chosen out so people can see a sample of inside the book. Unless they can do that on Amazon as well. They can see it on my website, martingrams.biz, B-I-Z. But hopefully, and I think enough people out there have a copy of the book, the good thing is it's a lot of praise. So I haven't seen a bad review about it yet.
Good. Glad to hear that. Last question before we let you go. And this is kind of harks back to you talked about David Koepp and his new script that they're working on at this point. If we ever see it, that's a good question. But where do you think the Hornet needs to go for the future?
For the future, just to be exposed to a younger audience is a good thing. If I had a preference, although it's more expensive than doing a modern day version because of the costumes and sets, I would still prefer to see a 1930s rendition, primarily because you want to see a darker rendition of the Hornet. You want to see the racketeers. Remember when they did the Shadow, they kept it at least in the Art Deco and everything from the 30s and 40s. So it looked good. It worked well with the Phantom. I'm just hoping that they harken back to more of its roots, if possible. And to be fair, David actually was responsible for some of those movies like The Shadow and so on. So I give him credit. He at least knows, and I know he has a copy of my book. We've talked briefly. And I did tell him, if you need to know where and you need any questions answered, do not hesitate to ask. I think it was he who asked at one point, where does the series take place on the radio show? And I said there were two episodes that made direct landmark references. It is New York City, just in case anyone's listened to the radio show and always wanted to know where it was. Some people think Chicago, some think Detroit. It's New York City. I have good faith. I have faith in him that he'll at least do a better rendition than Seth Rogen, but he actually gets the material. So fingers crossed, we'll see where it goes. But I would like to see a faithful rendition, but just any rendition at this point, even if it's a cartoon, would be nice to see it keep going.
That would be killer.
Kevin Smith cartoon? I don't know. What do you think?
I think there's a few services out there that could benefit from some noir animation. That would be killer. That's a really cool way of going about it that I didn't even think about before.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's on YouTube, but somebody did a 3-minute computer animated version of a pilot for a weekly series of the Green Hornet. I remember I got screen captures once sent to me and it looked awesome. And
I've seen it.
Good. I would have loved to have seen that.
I have seen that, and it's so tantalizing that it almost makes me, well, I guess I shouldn't say that on this podcast. It's a family show at this point. But
he's constantly trying to rein me in.
It's me. It's me. It's always about me. Martin Graham's the book. Oh, hang on. I got to pick it up off the floor. The Green Hornet, History of Radio, Motion Pictures, Comics, and Television. This is not going to be the only conversation we have, my friend. We're going to bring you back and talk more.
Looking forward to it.
So there we are.
Man.
That was fun.
Martin, he's so gracious and so insightful.
And a lot of information just crammed in that boy's brain.
Oh, yeah. He's fascinating to me. Absolutely fascinating.
Well, and you consider, too, I mean, he loves the Hornet, so he's got a lot of passion for that. Loves Lone Ranger. But you think about all the other books that he's done as well, and that just blows me away. He's
like
got all
40-some, right?
Yeah. Guy's not even 40 years old, I don't think, is he?
I just didn't think to ask him that.
Yeah, well, not going to. I love the conversation. I love the way the conversation flows about the Hornet. And as I've mentioned, you and I have talked many times about how and where we want this podcast to go. It needs to be a granular conversation about, you know, the beginnings of the Hornet. We've talked a little bit about with Martin, and you and I've had the conversation. You know, it was a product of the times, the criminals and so forth. You know, like Martin was saying, things changed over the years.
Well, and yeah, you're going from the racketeering of the 30s. You're coming out of Prohibition and into that era, you know, and then into the 40s with the he's fighting Nazis and that element. And then goes back a little bit to more, you know, mobsterish stuff. And then into communists.
Yeah.
In the 50s. Yeah. So you got straight up McCarthyism just bleeding into it. Like, it's all over the map. It's great. That's what you need.
Yeah. Because if it was the same thing over and over again, it would become very stale and boring very quickly.
Jimmy Stale.
The Gray Seal. There we go.
They're making fun of it. That's
I'm sorry, Jimmy.
But I do want to put this out there, because we talked about heavily how in those first episodes, those ones that weren't recorded, that the Hornet always left behind his seal.
Yes.
If you happen to find one around our area, it's just Greg.
It's just me. Because I actually stole that idea.
Yeah,
I know. When I go to Comic-Cons and I'm doing Green Hornet, I'm doing 66 Van Williams Green Hornet, for the most part, I do have the 40s version that I have not actually premiered at a con yet, but I'm going to.
Do we know which one?
Which one?
Which con?
No.
Okay.
No, right. Not, yet. Not yet. Not yet. Not yet. We're working on some here in the Pacific Northwest, but I would have, and I hate to even say this, I hate to bring this up, but would people would see myself and my buddy that goes with me that's dressed as the
Batman.
66 Adam West Batman. People look at me and go, it's the Joker or it's the Riddler. The Riddler. And I'm like, what? Come on. So I created my own seal, yep, sort of thing.
I have one in my wallet.
You have? Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I'm impressed now. So I've created, it's basically a bubblegum card kind of sized thing that I hand out, that on one side it says, it has the Green Hornet logo. I'm sorry, David Grace, I'm probably stealing that and you're going to sue me, I'm sure. But I'm making it good right now. So I have the Hornet logo on one side and it says, you've been stung. And then my website, greenhornet66.com, is at the bottom. On the reverse side, in very small print, because there's so much information, I do a quick breakdown, historical breakdown of the Green Hornet from the beginnings of, you know, being created by Trendle and Stryker and all the way up through the movie and beyond. So that's my own little way of coming to the table with my seal.
And that's what I like. I know I wasn't quite thinking about it in that frame until, and I'm sure that's, I mean, you were thinking of it.
Of course, yes.
But I wasn't thinking about it in that frame. I was just like, oh, he's doing it to inform people who do those.
But it was the same act of handing you know, you've been stung by the Green Hornet.
That's right.
So, yeah, there is that. These conversations are only going to get a little deeper and deeper. I was having a conversation with my wife about the things that we want to do. And she said, oh, you know, just even the conversation about Bruce and the lack of Asian influence in the 60s especially. Well, but you take that back, clear on back to, you know, the 40s.
Oh, yeah.
And Key Luke, you know.
Well, and as we've discussed this, as the ethnicity of Kato shifted much like the change of the villain.
Well, he's Asian, right? What is that?
Right. And then it's, you know, it's a touchy subject with speaking of in the parlance of that time. You know, but we had the shift of, you know, he's this or he's that. Or, well, suddenly it's not cool to be, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
In as far as mainstream culture of the United States at the time. And so that's a touchy subject, but one we want to tackle.
And we will. It is the Green Hornet Case Files. And it, again, thanks to Martin for coming on the show, and twice, actually.
Right.
One will never be heard. I can't even remember what it was now.
You know what? Here's the thing, dude. It's apropos.
Yeah.
It's the lost scripts, it's the man. Lost scripts. It wasn't recorded.
There you go.
It was done but not recorded.
And
as long as we don't hit 300 of them, we're fine.
Yeah, please don't. Again, we have so many people that have expressed interest in being on the show, and so many of you that have been listening to the show. And we, again, thank you so much for jumping in and streaming us.
Right? This reception has been mind-blowing to me.
Absolutely,
for sure.
Mind-blowing. Podcast at greenhornet66.com.
I was just about to bring it up.
There you go.
And anything you guys, if we misspeak, you know, if there's a correction to be made, we want to know.
Martin's the expert. We're not.
Right. And even he had a little misspeak.
Yeah.
So it happens to everybody. Correct us. We don't mind. We're here to learn as much as teach. Edutainment, if you will.
Edutainment. Podcast at greenhornet66.com. I don't want to sound too much like my radio days, because my wife is like, don't sound too much like radio.
when you lean way into it, I like it. I like corny.
I like it.
But at the end of the day, man, it's a strength. That's what we're doing. Just let it flow, dude.
It's the Green Hornet Case Files. Green Hornet 66.com. And I hope you'll join us again next week.
You ready to get out of here?
Let's do it.
Let's roll.
As the night envelops the city once more, our journey through the hidden alleys of history and valor comes to a close. You've been riding shotgun with the Green Hornet Case Files, where the echoes of the past meet the voices of the present. Tune in again for the next thrilling adventure, where shadows speak, secrets unfold, and the legacy of the Green Hornet continues to inspire. The Green Hornet Case Files is a Grail Productions podcast. The Green Hornet is owned exclusively by Green Hornet, Inc. Until next time, vigilant listeners, keep your wits sharp and your spirit unbreakable.